what triggered this bizarre behavior.
Journey into the cold heart of Northern Darkness with Nordic Crimes.
That case became like a scene from a horror movie.
A new true crime documentary series that chilled the bone.
The hunger for killing is increasing in the course of these homicides.
Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Nordic Crimes is a part of the Acast family.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome back to 1 Minute Remaining. My name is Jack Lawrence, the host and creator of this show. Today is part 8, and the final part, for now, in the story of Jeremy and Zachary Kane and Mark Harper, three teenage boys who were found guilty of the murder of Jimmy Hill in 2002 and sentenced to 35 years in prison. Over 20 years later, Jeremy and Zach are still incarcerated for this crime, a crime they say was self-defense. In our last episode, we heard the moment that the boys were all found guilty for murder. And as you can imagine, the scene in the courtroom was one of utter devastation for the boys and their families. A local news reporter who would write an article about that day would describe how tearful jurors would be led from the courtroom while the boys sobbed and pleaded to go home. Once found guilty, the boys would be taken in handcuffs into a room to see their parents before they were taken into custody.
What they did was they took us into custody and put handcuffs on us. They cleared the courtroom. Well, they removed the jury. Then they cleared the courtroom. And then they put us in the jury room and then allowed our parents to come in and see us for a few minutes and then took us to jail.
Wow, that few minutes with your family must have been awful.
Yes, it was pretty brutal. I mean, jail was rough. It was all bad. I mean, at that age, at that time, it was rough. I mean, I really feel sorry for the young people that come to prison today, because the prison system today is a whole lot worse. It was bad then, especially for someone young. But it's really bad now. But, I mean, I just know, like, when we come in, you know, coming in at that age, we went straight into the major facilities. Like, there was no area to put us with younger people or none of that. It was straight in with grown men. And then, you know, being that age and stuff, and especially being white in this prison system, you know, it was very difficult.
What jail did they ship you off to, and how long were you there for before you were sentenced?
I was in the Birmingham, Jefferson County Jail. They have two different jails. They have Bessemer and Birmingham. And we were in the Bessemer Division, and we got sentenced about 6 weeks later. And then we were there, I think I was there, it was March 8th, and I want to say in May I went to prison. I think I got sentenced in April. Yeah, sometime around my birthday in April we got sentenced. And then we all went to prison together. But, like, the entire time, my brother and the co-defendant, Mark, they were always together. in the county jail. They were on the same floor. One went to prison. They went to the same prison. But I was separated the entire time. But at that time, they did not allow family members to be in the same prison. And that's changed now. But back then, you couldn't do that. So I was separated the entire time by myself, didn't know anyone. And I never knew anybody went to prison. I mean, the part of town and stuff I lived in, there was not people weren't going to prison. So it was a big deal. It was just a smaller town, and it was a really, really big deal when someone died in that town. It was just a never happened before type situation.
So while Jeremy would go it alone and have to watch his own back, Zach and Mark, at the time, had each other. Here's Zach. Do you remember your first day arriving at the facility?
Oh, in prison, yeah. Like it was yesterday. But in my mind, I told myself in the county, I talked to dudes in the county that's been to prison, and they were like, man, look, you just got to fight, you got to do what you got to do, and just stay strong. I'm like, okay. So I created this whole new image of Zach. So in my mind, I'm a tough guy. I'm not going to be messed with. So the first thing I do, I go, everybody's scared to get in the shower. First thing I do, I go jump in the shower. Try me, you know, like try me. Come on, what's up? You know, and I never had no problems. I get to, that was at Kilby. That was my first day. I remember, like it was yesterday, I remember the first meal I ate, sweet and sour chicken with rolls. It wasn't really sweet and sour chicken. It was some dried cardboard meat with some sweet and sour sauce in it and some rice, but they call it sweet and sour chicken. And I thought the rolls were so good. I was like, oh my God, this is way better than the county jail. So we went through me and Mark was at Kilby together. My brother was on the hole on the other side of the prison. They wouldn't let me and him be in the camp together. And we left there and went to Draper. And the warden called me up front and said, all I want you to do is fight. He told me, he said, I want you to fight. He said, you're the youngest kid in my prison ever be in one of my prisons. He said, I want you to fight. And he said, you're not going to get in trouble. So that's what I did. Anytime somebody got wrong, I fought. And I fought some more, and I fought some more, until I didn't have no problems anymore. I mean, you get told to don't take crap from nobody. I'm talking officers, inmates, whatever. You don't take crap. You don't back down. You don't do none of that. So I got to create this image. I'm this super tough kid, and I'm fighting grown men. You know, like I'm fighting 40-year-olds, 30-year-olds. I'm 15.
Insane situation to be told by the warden that he wants you to fight.
Yeah, he told me to fight. He said, don't stab nobody. He said, I don't want you. Don't stab nobody. Don't. Breaking no boxes, 38s is masturbation on women, and I'm definitely not going to do that. And he said, as long as you don't do them three right there, he said, if you fight, I'll let you out of jail. He'd let me out. I might not even go to jail because I was so young. They did, now, lockup is what I mean by jail.
Yeah.
Solitary confinement. After a while, like, there was an officer, a sergeant there that called me up front and said, anything I needed, I could have, because his son, the guy I killed, his son was beat almost to death by this guy. There's a sergeant down there, the old dude named Sergeant, and he was there for about a year when I first got there, and he pretty much told me, he said, you did the world a favor, and I said, no, I didn't. I said, I know you feel like that, but to me, killing somebody is not doing the world a favor. Justice, judicial system should have been had him in prison. He should have never been out there.
You're a kid walking into a man's world. You don't know anyone. I mean, that I just can't even imagine. That must just be absolutely horrendously stressful.
I was very, very stressful. I mean, I was I think I ended up losing about like 125 pounds probably by the time I got to prison because I couldn't eat, couldn't sleep. I mean, I didn't know what to do. I mean, it was very bad. It was a bad situation.
So the first prison that you went to, what was that like arriving there on day one?
It was just a shock. I mean, I come in, the first prison I went to was a receiving facility, and you go there and they pretty much, they humiliate you pretty bad because they make you, they strip search you, they spray you with some stuff, some chemicals and stuff, and they make you get in a shower with a whole group of men, and it's pretty humiliating. I think they changed the way they do that now. That's the way it was then. And then they just throw you some like a jumpsuit to put on. And they tear up all your property and they throw all your stuff away, all your pictures and family, and they just treat you like crap. Shave your head. I mean, it was pretty rough. And then they just After that, they take you through processing. They put you in a dorm for like a week or two, do a bunch of blood work to see if you got any diseases or anything. Or they put you in the general population, and they put you, after about 2 weeks of that, they put you in general population, and it's a receiving facility, so you don't usually stay there very long. I have stayed like 9 months, usually only stay there about a couple of months. My brother and the other co-defendants, they were on there about 3 months, and then they left and went off to another facility. And then I think I was there about 9 months, and I went to another major facility. And then, I got there, and the way it's going to do things, when you're new to a facility, they usually put you in some of the worst dorms until the officers get to know you or whatever and see if you're a troublemaker or not. I was thrown into, one of the worst dorms. And then, I had several situations with inmates and stuff to defend myself and stop myself from being robbed and raped or whatever, which luckily I never was raped or anything. I did have situations where I had to fight to prove that, you weren't just, I wasn't going to be that guy that was just going to get in and be somebody's wife or something in here. So at that time, the way the system was, they threw you out there, and if you fought and defended yourself, the police, you didn't get disciplinary infractions and stuff. I think it was expected. They let you just figure it out for yourself. Just go in there and do whatever you got to do to survive.
You went in as a youngster, mm-hmm. very susceptible mm-hmm. to gangs and all that goes on in prison. How did you avoid all of that?
I mean, I just tried to stay away from it best I could. And when I came to prison, things are different. Now, it's a lot worse now than it was when I come to prison. I mean, not like it was a piece of cake back then or anything, but basically when I came to prison, as long as you stood up for yourself, I had to get in fights and stuff, then you pretty much didn't have major, major problems. If you weren't involved, I don't, the main thing is don't be involved in drugs. Don't borrow money. Don't give anybody a reason to want to do you harm, because they look for an excuse. They try to attack you from any angle they can. If they find a way to get in, they'll justify it in their mind because you borrowed, say, one soup, which would be like a dollar, roughly. They would try to, use that as an excuse to, now you owe me 10 or you owe me 100 or just as an excuse to prey on. If they think you're weak, they're just going to use that to prey on you. It was difficult, but I refused to be involved in that stuff. I mean, to me is if you join a gang, it's because you're scared or you need help or you want help. And I didn't want to be involved in that. And most of the gang stuff, especially the younger people, they just use them. They're going to use you for your money. They're going to use you for if you can fight really well. They're going to use you to do their fighting for them. They're going to use you any way they can, So that's how I avoided it. I'm not a follower. And a lot of people in here are followers. And that's just not me. And I mean, it wasn't easy. So I definitely got in, quite a good bit of fighting and stuff. And that was another thing. When the prison I was at, being as I was young and white, it made it harder. And where I was at, if I got in fights and stuff, I didn't get right up to disciplinary action or whatever for it, because they knew 99% of the time that I didn't have a choice.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Here's how Mark remembers his first days after being found guilty.
So you get the 35 years and they ship you off to prison. Do you remember the first day at the prison they sent you to?
We do like 4 more nights in the county. We catch the train down to the processing center, Kitty. And Jeremy has always been separate from me and Zach. Like in the county, I'm in G block. I can look through the glass and through where the officers stay, and I could see another block, and Zach would stick his head in every now and then and wave, you know? So I know he's like, he's all right. You know, like we'd check on each other like that. But Jeremy was on like the 8th floor, and it's crazy, but if you flush the toilets, you know, you can hear the people on the floors below. And so we communicate like that. So at that time, we go to the processing center, and he goes to some other part of the prison there, and me and Zach are together in this dorm, this M dorm, and we do 3 months there. Like a week prior to before we got shipped, I got robbed by some gang members, and I went to go confront them, and they got out of hand. I got to embrace that, like, animal in me. You know what I mean? Like, I got to be nastier than the nastiest people in here.
Yeah.
So they locked him up and locked me up for a day, but then brought me back to the dorm. And then that following week, man, Zach gets shipped out. And fortunately, I was supposed to go to another prison, but I guess the incident made me catch the train quicker, and we went to the same prison. And I couldn't believe it, you know, having Zach with me. That was like a big confidence thing, man.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
At the time, he's the youngest prisoner in Alabama, and I'm the third youngest prisoner.
Zach said to me that he was, in fact, told by the warden himself that he had to fight. He had no option, really, and he wanted him to fight and to stick up for himself.
Right. Like, I think he would not fight, and I feel sorry for some people. You know, they'll end up throwing them in the shower and you know, have 10, 15 people run up, you know, rape them. It's disgusting. You know what I mean? And, you know, you got officers that are part of gangs, correctional officers, you know. You got, the whole thing's corrupt, you know. Like where I was at, there's probably 1,400 black people, 500 white people. But you just see white people just get done wrong. But we made it a point to establish respect in there. We're doing good, but we're also catching disciplinaries. Can't imagine how many Zach's got now.
Him and Mark went to the same prison, but I went to a different prison, so I didn't know anyone. And they expected you to fight. I mean, they wanted you to. If you didn't, then they knew that you were not going to do very well. Because I mean, the people they're gonna send people at you from any angle possible. Like it's gonna be try to loan you something, try to get you high. They send people, they'll pay people to try to steal your stuff, to see if you're gonna fight about your stuff, to see if you're gonna go tell the police, to see there's every way they can and just to try to wear you down and take advantage of you.
You're constantly being tested.
I mean, most constantly. And if they see that you're weak or you won't stand up for yourself, then in the end, you're going to end up being, the bare minimum, you're not going to be able to have anything. I mean, anything you buy, they're just going to take from you and that kind of thing. I mean, if you're too weak, then you're going to end up having, you know, you're going to be involved in the homosexual side of things where, you know, I guess in here they call you have a man or something, or if you don't stand up for yourself, you got to have somebody else protect you, for you. That's the, you know, kind of crazy thing, because I end up in this altercation with this man and end up in prison. for the stuff that he did to Mark. And then I come here and you know, I'd never even thought or seen or nothing, anything like that. And then I get to prison and then it's like that type of stuff is almost normal. You know, not exactly what he did, but I mean, the verbiage, the way he was talking, acting and that kind of thing. And that's the type of stuff that you would see in here. And then I'm like, I'm in a situation where like, okay, I've got to fight to defend myself, but I don't need somebody accidentally dying again. Or now I'm even in worse shape. Luckily, in all the altercations since then, luckily no one's died. But it changes from that point. Just if you get in a fight, not a problem. If someone dies, now it's a whole other thing. Oh, well, even though you're defending yourself, now you're fixing to get all kind of trouble and write-ups and SAG, and you're probably going to get a charge. And a lot of times, I mean, there's a lot of people, sadly, especially nowadays, not nearly as bad as when we first come in, but that die and get killed, and the person that does it, a lot of times, don't even get in any trouble, or it's very minor for what they did. It's ridiculous today. I mean, the last 5 to 10 years, it's gotten a whole lot worse. And, you know, for someone coming in the age we were coming in now, I don't know how they can make it without killing someone or getting killed. It's just it's that bad.
You know, like they already know who we are before we even hit the back gate to this place called Draper. And they're like, oh, the Bat Boys are here. You know, and you could just see like it go throughout the thing, the prison. So they think they got some fresh white dudes. They got the, I guess, rape and all that. So they found out real quick that we ain't the one.
So when we first come in, it was more or less, as long as you fought for yourself, then that was usually enough. As long as you didn't get involved in anything extra, like drugs or borrowing or gambling and that kind of thing, as long as you stood up for yourself, it was enough. Now, if you get involved in that, then it's all bets are off, because if you owe somebody or something, then you might have, you know, this gang or that gang or just cities. It's usually more or less cities. You have gangs, but it's in Alabama, it's more what city you're from. If you're from a major city and say you owe this guy in this city $10, which been here, they say items or tops or cigarettes or coffee or whatever, but we'll just say $10. And you don't have the money to pay them on time, then they're going to send people to jump on you, and it might be 10 people. So as long as you don't get involved in that kind of thing, then most of the time ends up being a one-on-one situation. And usually when you take up for yourself, people would step in at some point. Okay, we see he's not going to back down. Leave him alone. Find somebody else that's weaker. You know, so if you're the type of person that's trying to rob, steal, or take advantage of people, you obviously want to find the easiest route to go. But nowadays, it really don't matter. They don't care. If you have something someone wants in these major facilities, they'll do pretty much anything. They'll try to kill you to get if you have something that they want. It's that messed up nowadays.
You go into prison in the South where there is a high population of African Americans. Were you outnumbered when it came to race?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Today, it's closer to like maybe 60-40.
Right.
But when I come in, it was probably more like 80-20, 85-15. So, yeah, that made it a lot more difficult, for sure. I mean, it's worse today than then, but not the ratios, but it's just worse all around. And that definitely plays a huge role. It's ridiculous that it does, but in Alabama especially, and I'm sure most of the South, race is a very big role. I would say pretty much all the circumstances I got in was black versus white.
Yeah.
Every time. It's ridiculous, but that's how it is.
What was your first port of call when it came to appeals? What was your first attempt with an appeal?
We had a Rule 32, I believe, that was filed initially, because that's a whole other thing. Like, there's stuff missing from my transcript, but the lawyers that was instant were the district attorney during closing arguments made a reference to us not testifying. He got up there and was doing his closing argument and said, well, what we're saying has got to be true, because they didn't get up here and tell you anything different. They must have done it, you know, and that's a blatant prosecutorial misconduct. It should have been an automatic mistrial. And all the lawyers objected and made a huge fuss about it. We didn't really understand what was going on. They had to explain it to us. So they all wrote affidavits saying what they heard, and it should have been an automatic mistrial. Well, they get the transcripts back, and it's not in the transcripts. And then the lawyers go and meet with the stenographer and supposedly get the recording, the audio recording, and listen to it and say that they misheard what he said. But we never could get a copy of that tape. So all we have to go on is the actual transcript. And I can't, there was some other things that was missing in there also. And I don't remember what they were off the top of my head now. That's just the main one I remember. And the transcripts and stuff were doctored to make sure we couldn't win anything on an appeal. And, you know, the lawyers, they just sold us out. They just backed out. Like, oh, no, we misheard it. We're wrong. Everybody in the courtroom heard it. There wasn't no mishearing it. We heard what was said. Y'all made a huge deal out of it. We never would have realized it was wrong if they didn't object to it. But the objections, none of that stuff's in the transcript. It's all gone.
Yeah,
and
right.
When you try to use that in appellate reason, the appellate courts just go by what's in the record of the transcript. And if it's not in there, you can't appeal on the ground. And then there's another situation. Like I had told my mom and my dad both, anytime they talk to someone, make sure they record it. Well, my mother went and spoke with the district attorney after my Rule 32 was denied, a few years after I was incarcerated, and he asked her why we did not take the deal of a 20-5. And she said, well, she never knew of any deal. I filed in court on that and went back on that ground. And when the judge asked the district attorney, I said, was there ever any deal offered? The district attorney said, oh, no, there's never any deal offered. But he just told my mother 6 weeks prior that he offered us a deal. But my lawyer never told me about it. So he just flat out lied. That's just what they do. I don't understand why. I mean, I know why. They're politicians. They can't admit they withheld something or changed something or lied about something. They can't say any of that because they'll lose everything. You know, lose their jobs, their pensions, they'll lose everything if they can be shown or proven that they tampered with evidence or anything like that. So they're not going to do that.
In the boys' current situation, they are and have been eligible for parole on several occasions. Each time they come up for that parole, people who are originally involved in the trial and the case are asked for their opinions on if they believe that the boys should be granted their release. Prosecutors, police, judges, and family members all have the right of response. Apparently, in these situations, there really is only one person who continues to object, and that is Mr. Hill's former wife. Here's the boy's father.
Well, every time they come up for parole, his wife, his ex-wife, they'd only been married 7 months. She's there protesting every time. She's there. She's there. She's there. And I don't even understand why. I don't understand what. I've never done nothing to this woman. I never said anything bad about her. I don't even know her. You know, I don't understand what her vindictiveness is towards my kids. My kids never done nothing to her. And her husband done all this stuff to himself, as far as I'm concerned. But she's there every time to make sure they don't get. And this next time when we go, I'm going to have a big portfolio, and I'm going to give it all to the people up there on the parole board. I'm going to say, here, this is what this woman is harping about. Here's his background right here. I've got folders and folders of what he did.
Of course, the opinions of those involved in the case are not the only reason that they may or may not be granted parole. And according to the boys, parole in the Alabama prison system is essentially non-existent.
You've gone for parole a few times and, you know, obviously have not been successful.
Nobody makes parole in Alabama.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Yeah. Especially for supposed violent crimes, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, any crime. There's nobody making parole.
Yeah.
You can have, now there's nobody. I mean, they're not letting nobody out on parole. They might say they are, but the people they're picking, like, for mandatory release, I just watched them do mandatory release, people that had a year or less, and they were letting them go. And I'm at Limestone Prison. This is before I got here. I was at Limestone Prison. It's the worst prison in the state. And you're letting people out of lockup to go home that's got stabbing cases, that's got drug charges, that's got all kinds of stuff they've been caught with in prison that's not getting charged for it. Literally, like, getting caught with ounces of drugs and stabbing people and robbing people and whatever it may be, fighting with a weapon, whatever. And guess what? They're letting them out. I let them out. Those are the people that are letting out. The people that need parole. I watched a guy in Staten. This is back before they stopped people from getting out because they just quit now. But this is, let's see, 2018. Yeah, about 2018. There was a guy there, stabbed a guy the day before he went up for parole. He made parole. Still has a disciplinary. Made parole. 4 weeks later, he stabs another guy the day before he goes home. They just put him in a holding cell until they release him the next morning.
My God.
The people they want to let out on the street. Because they want people to come back. They want them to commit crimes so they can justify the reason of keeping people in prison.
Yeah, now the legal system is here. It's up to us. It's a three-panel board, and the decision is entirely up to them. Whatever they want to do, it's yes or no. They got to give no reason why. They don't give it to you. It's whatever they feel like. And currently with the political situation in the state right now, there was a guy that was on parole about 4 years ago that was that killed someone while on parole.
Oh,
and
no.
Since then, no violent offense. He didn't have a violent offense, but they punished all the violent offenders for what he did, and he had a burglary offense. But they just went back, oh, we can't have anybody out of prison on parole with a violent offense because they might commit another violent offense, even though it's statistically proven that most violent offenders don't reoffend. It's the non-violent offenders that reoffend the most. So they're worried about, well, you committed one violent offense. There's a possibility you might do it again, so we just ain't going to let you out because we don't want to be responsible.
As Jeremy has stated to me in the past, he really believes that the only way they'll ever get themselves back into court is for any of the witnesses to come forward and say that the DA at the time instructed them on what to say, especially the main witnesses, Chris Stano or Paul Gillian. And this is his message to them, if they're listening.
I mean, for Chris, I can understand his situation. He was a kid and didn't have, they threatened him with sending him to prison for the rest of his life, and he's doing what he was told to do, and I kind of understand it, but you're a grown man now, so... I think, it'd be time for you to man up and just tell the truth. And Paul Gillian, I don't know what made him do what he did. I don't understand it. Whatever it was that made him say what they wanted him to say, whether he thought maybe he was doing the right thing, or I don't know what he thought. Because, I do feel like with him, obviously he don't know the whole circumstance. He saw whatever bit he saw. I know he didn't say as much as he tried to talk about in court, but, maybe... because someone died, maybe he felt he was doing the right thing, or what? I don't know what he felt, but I just wish he would realize that he made a mistake and just tell the truth. With the whole truth, if the jury would have found me guilty and they both told the truth about what happened, then obviously I'd feel a little different about him. That 12 people thought that, based on the truth, that I did something wrong. But I just don't feel like if they know everything, that people will feel that way. You know what you did and do the right thing. That's really all I want to ask of either of them. Tell the truth. That's all I ask for. I don't know nothing else, just the truth. Both of them know that that's not what they did. But other than that, that's really about it.
As we know, Mark would eventually get out of prison after his attorney puts through an appeal based on medical grounds. Here's Mr. Kane, Jeremy and Zach's father.
He didn't take a deal. His lawyer made him a deal that he was going to get out in 3 years. When he was in prison with my son, he was in prison, always in prison with Zachary. Zachary called us up and said, Mark keeps telling, asking his daddy when he's going to get out. He's not going to get out till you get out. I said, he's going to be in there for the whole time. And then he called us up one time and said, Mark's having a fit with his daddy. He said he's supposed to be out within 3 years. I'm thinking, what in the hell? I said, there's no such thing, Zachary. He's not getting out in 3 years. Sure enough, he got out in 3 years. Now, the reasoning for him to get out, this is what his appeal was or whatever it was. He couldn't take his medication for his bipolar, so therefore he couldn't testify in his own defense. Okay, the trial is consolidated. He was supposed to testify in our defense too, right? So why is the same appeal no good for us but good for him? If he couldn't take his medicine, couldn't testify for his own self, he couldn't testify for our behalf either. But that was turned down for us, but it wasn't turned down for him. You know, I haven't spoke to Mike basically since the day that happened, but, you know, he met with a woman that's the deceased husband, I know, once or twice. I found that out later. I don't know how much money he gave her. Or I don't know nothing about no money. This is just all speculation. But it basically, she signed off on it. He walked away.
So,
you know, I don't know.
One of the reasons for overturning his time, he got 35 years, and then they take his 35 years away and give him a 25 time served. He only did 3 years on it because his medication problems. I was having medication problems. I was on Adderall, which was messing me up, and it made me angry, and they took me off of that, and I was in the process of getting put on something else, but at the time I was having just like real bad, just, I don't know, I was getting angry all the time. But no, that don't matter. But that's the reason you let him out. But you don't let me out, I mean, for the same reason?
Me and him don't. I ain't talked in so long. And I think he, you know, when I was in there, you know, like, I made it a point to be like, I appreciate what you did, Zach, but ultimately we both got us hit. Your brother didn't, Stano didn't. And, like, you know, looking at each other eye to eye, like we swallowed that. You know, like, we're here for 35, you know what I mean? So we made amends back then, but it wasn't until, you know, I got out, you know, which I can, you know, I can see. That's why I don't fault him for nothing, but I got him there. It's all on me and this and that, you know. If I was him, I'd probably blame it on me too, you know.
So you think he's resentful of you?
Yeah.
You know you're the reason I'm in prison.
And to be fair on Mark, he did say that he does, because I said to him, look, do you have guilt over this situation, over the fact the boys are still in prison? And he did say, yes, I do have guilt every single day that, you know, the reason that they're in prison is because of my feud with this family.
Yeah, he has, yeah, I mean, he don't care, in my personal opinion.
And I really don't care about me. Get my brother out of prison. That's all I care about. Just get my brother out. I don't care about nothing else. I'll do the rest of this time. I don't care. Just get him out. Let him have a life. I'm tired. I'm really tired. And he shouldn't be in here either. He definitely shouldn't be. I killed him. I didn't mean to, but I did.
You have 1 minute remaining.
This is the story of the Kane brothers for now. But as always, we will keep you up to date with their situation. And of course, if there's anyone listening to this who would like to offer some information that you think could be helpful for the boys, you can get in touch with me through email or Facebook, the details of which are in the description of this episode. Jeremy and Zach are two brothers that obviously have a strong bond and love each other very much. In fact, Zach says the reason he swung the bat that day was to protect his brother. It was an act that would see them both in prison. But what if you believed that your brother was the one that put you in prison on purpose?
And that's the second I knew that Don and Mattioli were setting me up. I never knew until then.
Stephen Lawrence believes his own brother framed him for the murder of their father.
It reminded me of The Godfather when I walked in and saw him sitting in there in that black suit with two armed guys next to him.
Next time on 1 Minute Remaining. 1 Minute Remaining is a Mashed Pumpkin production, created, hosted, and produced by Jack Lawrence. Audio and sound design by Jack Lawrence and Dom Evans of Earsay.